usually people come up and give suggestions for the talks, but because I've been happily ensconced in my meditation retreat down in Serpentine, haven't seen many of you for a while, there's no suggestions for a talk, so it's a wonderful opportunity to just to talk about just general Buddhism. Because the question which I often get asked, actually, what is Buddhism? Put it in a nutshell, please. And the best description, in a nutshell, in brief, is what is inscribed underneath the statue outside. To do what is good, not to do what is bad, and to purify the mind. What does that actually mean? Now, first of all, when you say to do what is good, not to do what is bad, that seems quite obvious, but we get here into the whole idea of goodness and badness and ethics in the world, which obviously affect us quite dramatically. Many people think that goodness or badness is something which is fixed in the world. But the principles are fixed, but actually how goodness and badness actually evolve in our daily lives, they change from generation to generation, from time to time. What was good yesterday is not necessarily good today. What is bad yesterday is not necessarily bad tomorrow. What do I mean by that? But the principles of goodness and badness, they stay the same. For example, I was asked today a common question which they ask Buddhist monks. Because Buddhists are not supposed to kill any animals, because we're supposed to be so gentle and kind, even to things which crawl on the ground, I say, what happens when, say, our dog or our cat is so sick? Should we take it to the vet and have it put down? Or should we just let it suffer in the back of our house? What should we do? And it's a very good question. And I bring this question up because I was asked that this afternoon before I came here. And it brings into focus what we really mean by Buddhist ethics, to do what is good and not to do what is bad. What does that mean in practice? My answer, because I've been asked this many times, is if you've got, say, a cat who's very sick, and you're thinking, should I take it to the vet and kill it, or should I allow it to live? My answer is, ask the cat. Now, straight away, you get some understandings here about that answer. First of all, that what right have you to judge what other people want? Too often in what we call ethics and goodness and bads, we're telling other people what's good for them or what's bad for them. And of course, you cannot tell. You cannot say to another being what's good and what's bad because they've got their own history, their own reasons why they do these things. It's one of the things I've been saying for a long time. Everybody, when they do an act, they think they do it out of goodness. I've been saying this for a while, even Osama bin Laden thinks that what he was doing is right. I read a report about this recently, and the thing, it was the historian Trevor Roper in England. He had access to Adolf Hitler's diaries. Not only his diaries, but apparently that because of probably that man's conceit, Hitler's conceit, he had a stenographer, someone who would write down his conversation over dinner for many years and record it for posterity. And this man, Trevor Roper, actually went through all of those diaries and probably knew the character of Adolf Hitler more than better than anybody else. And this interviewer asked him, was Adolf Hitler a bad man? Did he realize he was doing bad? And in this article I read, Trevor Roper, the British historian, said, no, no, no. Adolf Hitler was an idealist. He really thought that what he was doing was right. Fascinating. I've always said this, but in this article they said actually even Socrates said the same. Now this gives an interesting idea about what goodness is and what badness is. Sometimes we can't see it. We think we're doing what's right. But when afterwards, and the years which have gone past, everybody understands that what he was doing was a terrible crime against humanity. He was an idealist at the time. What about you? Maybe you may not be as powerful and as giving such an impression on the world as a Hitler, But some of the things which you do, are they good or are they bad? The point is, you always think you're doing good things, but sometimes, in retrospect, they're bad. Sometimes you may be going through a divorce, and you get so upset about that person that you actually do really mean and wrong things to them. I read about this person going through a divorce in New York. The wife still had the key to the man's apartment. Went in there on Friday evening after she knew her ex-husband or the husband she was divorcing was going to go away for the weekend with his new girlfriend. She picked up the phone and rang England for the automatic time and left the phone off the hook all weekend. There was a 2-day phone call overseas and this huge, a few thousand dollar bill. She just did that out of spite. That's a stupid thing to do. I think if you've been through a divorce, you probably understand that sometimes you feel like doing the same or doing something even more mean. But she thought it was a good thing to do at the time. She thought that person needed being taught a lesson. How often is it that we think we're doing good, but only afterwards we find out it was the wrong thing to do, a stupid thing to do? Now, going back to the cat, when you say ask the cat, it's so hard if we can't even judge ourselves to judge others what's good and bad. So I say ask the cat, by which I mean if you've got a pet which you love very dearly, which you've had in your house, in your family for such a long time, you will understand this, so you have got a connection with that being. By asking the cat is opening your mind to actually what that being wants. Not prejudging, thinking you know everything about what's good and bad, but actually opening your mind to see what that cat wants. And if you just do that, just to say, I'm going to ask my cat, my dog, what do you want? Do you want to go to the vet? Have you had enough yet? Or do you want to carry on for a while? Straight away that you will feel that empathy you have with that being, you will actually feel, you will know the answer. You look in that cat's eyes, there'll be a connection there. You don't have to have psychic powers and read the mind of that being, but you'll feel, you'll know whether that cat has had enough. If so, take it to the vet. You realize that he wants to end it. He's had enough. Sometimes you realize it hasn't had enough yet. He still wants to live. You can feel that. You feel it's the wrong thing to do. Don't do it then. Wait. Sometimes the cats can live like that, the dogs can live like that for many, many months, and they just die in your home. Surely they may be in physical pain, but it's the emotional pain I'm talking about. They'd rather be with you rather than going to the vet. So that gives an indication of the complexity of what's good and bad and how you actually find out. Sure, it says in a Buddhist text that it's against the precepts to intentionally kill a living being. But what does that really mean? One of the problems with these laws of good and bad is when we look in the texts, whether it's Buddhist texts, Christian texts, other people's authorities, and we follow what they do. It's like the cat being told, okay, now you have to go to the vet and die. Or the cat being said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I can't kill you, you have to stay here. And the cat, take me, I've had enough. The point is that goodness and badness does not lie in books, it cannot be told by anyone else. It lies in the heart of every human being and even every other being. You feel what is right and what is wrong deep inside of you. And this is not coming from precepts, from books. One of the greatest problems with the human race is that we follow books much more than we follow our heart. The books are there like maps. If any of you have come here for the first time, you'd have probably looked at the UBD for Nansen Way and use that as your guide to find how to get here. But if you look in the UBD, just that's not a scale version. The roads are actually amplified. And you know, the roads aren't yellow, they're grey. Whatever it is, those maps are only approximations to how to get here. In the same way as the words in the books, even the advice from a monk, are just approximations. And so we use the words in the book to actually to try and find out the truth in our hearts. If you stay with the books, we'll have fundamentalist wars. Who's got the best book? But the point is, you don't need a book to tell you what's right and what's wrong. But it tells you how to find out what's right and what's wrong. You feel it in your heart. That's why that most people, sometimes you'll be going to a religion, you'll be listening to talks, you'll be studying the texts. And if you follow those texts, and I'm saying that if you're a Buddhist or a Christian or whatever, and you just follow those texts blindly, you will not be a moral person. You'll be puritanical. But if you follow your heart, like asking the cat or the dog, then you'll be a compassionate, moral, wise person. And you feel that that is what goodness means. Goodness comes from the heart, not from the books. So we use those books to actually to find out in ourselves what goodness is. And the wonderful thing is that it doesn't matter what race you come from, what religion you come from, what gender, or even what time, there's something which you know inside yourself is good. You recognize that. That's goodness. And you recognize something which is badness. You know if you see someone being hit, if you see that someone who needs your attention, your time, is being left alone. If someone is hungry, you feel inside, that is not right. That's bad. You feel that inside. That's really what badness is. So, the Buddha actually gave this beautiful teaching to his son, Rahula. And this is actually the textual authority for what runs my life as what's good and what's bad. He told his son, if it's anything which hurts or harms another human being or hurts and harms yourself, that is what we mean as bad. If it hurts or harms you or hurts or harms somebody else, you feel it inside of you. This is not right. I shouldn't be doing this. This should not be happening. Hurting and harming has a huge implications of what hurts physically, what hurts mentally, what hurts emotionally, people in the world. If it helps, brings happiness and peace, harmony to others. If it brings happiness and peace and harmony to yourself, then that is good. And you feel that this is actually resonates with what you understand inside of yourself as being good, what's being bad. Because as human beings, that we want to create a world of peace and harmony, we want to limit the harm, the hurt which is in the world. If you actually see someone who is suffering, what's your reaction? If you see someone who's crying, who's afraid, who's hungry, who's lonely, don't you feel that someone should do something about this, or maybe me? You do feel that. Maybe that you deny that because you're busy or you're running off somewhere. But inside we feel that we want to help. We want to lessen the suffering in this world. Now when you go and help that suffering, that is called goodness. You're bringing happiness to others. But a wonderful thing occurs when you practice this way of goodness, just responding from your heart rather than from your book. Responding because you want to help, you want to serve, you want to create happiness. You find that creates happiness for you as well. I'm just one of the people who comes here regularly who serves in the prisons, visiting prisoners, was saying to me just a few moments ago how much of a privilege it is to go to a prison and spend time teaching prisoners meditation. And I can understand that very easily. It's not a chore to do good things. If it is a chore, you're not doing good. There's something wrong there. Something is not right with your actions. if you're doing good things, really helping others, it helps you. You feel good about it. It brings you happiness straight away. When I was a student at Cambridge, I had a friend who was a Christian. I was a Buddhist. He said he was going to do some social service in a home for in an institution for Down syndrome people. I thought, he's a Christian and doing that. I can't let the team down. I'm a Buddhist. So I said, I'll go along as well. It was pure conceit, I must admit, just trying to keep up with the Joneses or the Christians in these particular cases. So I went along as well. And it was four Christians and one Buddhist. And for 2 years, every, I think, Thursday afternoon, I went to this hospital. And I remember the name now, Fulbrook Hospital, just outside of Cambridge, to spend one afternoon a week just doing some occupational therapy with these Down syndrome kids. It came to the time when my university career was about to be finished. I always remember this occasion with a lot of sense of happiness and bliss, because the afternoon was separated by a tea time. Even in hospital, English people like to have afternoon tea, and so did in this hospital. So after one session, it was afternoon tea, another session, and then I went back to my college. There were two classes, or two groups, of Down syndrome children. They asked me, because I was so experienced by this time, even though I was a student without any formal qualifications, they gave me the whole group for one the first period in the afternoon. After tea, they said, do you mind taking the other group? So I took the other group just by myself. After we finished, the two groups came together. When I'd been teaching one group, the other occupational therapist had been helping the Down syndrome children make little cards for me. Because they said it was your last day. The final examinations are coming next week. And they told me that of all the students ever volunteered, I'd been the most consistent, the longest. I'd long outlasted the Christians, but I'd forgotten it wasn't a competition anymore. And these kids gave me these little cards. Now, if you get a card from a child, sometimes it's not very pretty, and they had to put a lot of effort in just to make a little card for you. If it's people with Down syndrome, the effort is two or three times, if not more. And those little kids had tried their hardest to say thank you. I cried at that time. And the funniest thing was that very sheepishly, when they gave me this presentation for my last day, I said, actually, my exams don't start for another week. Please, can I come back one more time? So after my last day, I came back another time. And I looked back, why? Why did I want to come back? Because when you give, when you do something which is good for others, it is always good for you. If you give happiness to others, you get what in Buddhism we call instant karma. You get instant happiness back. Whenever you're kind, whenever you're caring, whenever you do something which you know is not good in the books, but it's good in your heart. You forgive someone, you care for someone, you give that extra bit of time for someone. You give a charity a donation, you stop doing bad things, you say sorry for all the rotten things which you said to someone else. You just try that, and you get this wonderful sense of happiness back. If you give happiness to others, it creates happiness for you. If you create harm for others, if you hurt them, be honest, and you'll find it hurts yourself as well. That's just the law of nature. Whatever harms others hurts you. Whatever hurts you harms others. That's why when you see this clearly, ethics becomes so obvious. You know what to do, and you really can't hurt or harm again. It just makes absolutely no sense whatsoever to hurt or harm another being. It also makes no sense to do bad to yourself, to hurt or harm yourself. Why on earth does anyone do that? sometimes even in a monastery, teaching serves a young monk. So those people training to be monks, even though it's been a retreat time, we call it a time of rest for our monks, this period of the Range Retreat. We call it a period of rest because the rest of the monks have nothing to do, but I carry on working. It's a retreat for the rest of them, but not for me, because I have to teach them. So on that period when I've been away, I've still been very active teaching, but focusing on the monks and the Anagarikas, the lay people, lay women at my monastery, giving them full attention. And so often, one of the problems they have is they sleep in, or they have sexual fantasies, or they say something rotten and mean, and they come up, they feel so guilty. They say, I don't deserve to be in this monastery anymore. So I've been terrible. This is what I've been doing. And say, get out of your guilt trip. Because what's wrong with that? What's wrong with sleeping in? What's wrong with having that sexual fantasy? What's wrong with doing that? Look, you're a human being. You make mistakes. You're here to learn. I don't expect you to be perfect. But the important thing is, why do you want to punish yourself? Why is it when people do something wrong, they want to add to the suffering by hurting themselves again with guilt? What is bad is what hurts another person or hurts you. Isn't guilt harming yourself, hurting yourself? And it doesn't help. If you punish yourself because you've done something wrong, you think, I'm terrible, but please hurt me. And then it doesn't help at all to solve the underlying problem. As I've been saying recently, you do not learn from your mistakes. You learn from your successes. What does that mean? It means you stop focusing on your mistakes all the time, all the things you've done wrong, all the things that they've done wrong. It just makes you depressed, negative, and you find you will be repeating those mistakes every time you bring them up. Instead, you learn from your successes. So leave aside the faults or the things you've done wrong. How about thinking about all the things you've done right? All the wonderful things you've done in life. You'll find that that gives you energy, that builds you up, makes you feel good about yourself, gives you happiness, and you will do those things again. You learn from successes, not from failures. But what is it in our life? We've been taught, we've been conditioned. Okay, you've done a mistake. And we have to keep thinking about it and thinking about it, going over it, making sure we don't do it again. That's the way of our Western world. It's a way of guilt, focusing on the faults. It's actually creating more badness in our world and in ourselves. So the Buddhist way, which goes against the way many of you have been taught, you make a mistake, forget it. You do something right, celebrate it. I learned this, first of all, in educational psychology over 30 years ago. So I was a teacher and did 1 year teaching training course. Educational psychology was called positive reinforcement. Teachers would stop punishing the children or even telling them off when they made a mistake. But when they did something right, they would praise and celebrate. Even to the point, there was one group of people who had an eating disorder, a very severe eating disorder, that they could not keep food down in their stomachs. As soon as it went down the stomach, it would vomit it up again. I'm not quite sure what that disorder was called, but the group, the therapy group, which had the greatest success, was having all the children with their parents and nurses in one room. When any child kept that food down for more than 10 seconds, the party hats would come out. They'd have these little things they'd blow out, you know, with a little thing comes out with a feather on the end. They'd get on the chairs, they'd put on the children's favourite music, they'd be dancing and making a party because one kid kept their food down for 10 seconds. They found that the children started keeping their food down longer and longer. Until many of those children got over that syndrome. Positive reinforcement. Don't you like being encouraged and praised? if we start criticizing ourselves, we lose all energy, we lose all wanting to try anymore. How many of you have faced such criticism? You think, what's the point? You give up trying. That's negative reinforcement. How many of you got down, so down upon yourself, feeling, I'm at fault, I'm terrible, I'm hopeless? If you keep remembering your mistakes, focusing on what's wrong, you won't grow. So instead of remembering our mistakes, we remember our successes. And that becomes an encouragement. That's where we grow. So there's no reason for guilt, because guilt is almost like psychotic, morbid, focusing on what we do wrong. To the point that when you look at your day or your year, you focus excessively on all the things which you've done wrong. That's why you can't be happy. That's why you can't grow spiritually. And focus on your successes. You become a much more peaceful, happy, successful person. Guilt is harming yourself. Forgiving, focusing on the successes, is helping yourself. Creating happiness. That is why it is ethical. It is good. Whatever helps or heals is good. And you know this in your heart. You try that. So those little monks and anagarikas who made a mistake, do not punish yourself. Just forgive them. I told them, whenever I made a mistake or did something wrong, or go went and confessed to my teacher, Ajahn Chah, and I went in there just full of remorse, I did this terrible thing, please punish me. That's what I was saying. And he thought it was so funny. He'll just burst out laughing. And I think, these Westerners, they're really weird. You couldn't understand them at all. Why do you want to be punished? Just acknowledge, forgive, learn, forget about it. That was his attitude. And it took me years to change and to trust that way and to realize that is the way of growth. That's compassion. That's growth. That's creating happiness in the world. Forgive. Forgive yourself, at least. Have you forgiven yourself yet for all the bad things you've done? Or are you still doing what is bad by creating hurt, harm and hurt in yourself? That's bad. So if those anagarikas, those novices, those young monks, they continue to resist, I say, okay, you can have the punishment. We've got a punishment in my monastery. Some of you have heard this before. It's called 30 strokes of the cat. You know, in the old Australian tradition, you know what they used to do with the convicts? In my monastery, it's very strict. 30 strokes of the cat I give them. It's true. You know what that means? We've got a little cat in our monastery called Kit Kat. I tell them, you've got to stroke that cat 30 times. That's called 30 strokes of the cat. Many of you know that was like a punishment, a whipping. But I said, no, we don't do that in our monastery. I remember when I first told that story, the joke, I think I told it in Singapore, and people thought, what? You can't do that. When I told, they were both relieved. But there was a point to that. Because if you can't forgive yourself, it means you're very weak on compassion and wisdom. Animals are great for learning compassion. Go and take a cat or a dog and stroke it 30 times. Learn compassion. If you can be compassionate to that little cat, then maybe you'll get the hint and you'll be compassionate to yourself and forgive yourself and stop punishing yourself. That's what we call doing good. You create goodness. You take away the pain of life. You take away the pain of human beings making mistakes or making faults. You start doing that to yourself, and my goodness, you can start doing that to others. You find you can forgive others their faults. And you find that that is good. Punishing is bad. That's why the Buddha actually said, put away the rod. It's a hard thing for people to understand. It takes a lot of confidence. You have to do it, the positive reinforcement as well. Put aside the hard tongue and all the terrible things you say. Stop punishing others. Be kind. You get much, much, much more success with that kindness. Even just this afternoon, someone says that the bees get attracted to honey, not to vinegar. Goodness comes from kindness, not from harm or hurt. And that's such an important part of why that Buddhism has grown and been so strong in so many countries and been so gentle and actually healed people, has actually created harmony between people, accepted people, creating happiness in that space between people. I think many of you know it's on the board outside that I got awarded this John Curtin Medal. The thing which, actually one person gave this wonderful, they wrote a letter to me, and they said, isn't it wonderful that in this day and age you can get a medal not for going to war? Too many medals come from going to war or competing against other people in Olympics or in sport. But I got a medal not for going to war, but for going to peace. Not for competing, but for cooperating. Because the person who actually nominated me was the Anglican chaplain of Curtin University, Dr. Eric von Dietzer. So it's like a member of the Fremantle Dockers nominating a member of the Eagles. I like that idea. Because it's actually bringing people together, and we know that is good. We feel that's really right. That's good. That's not punishing or celebrating. It's not sort of focusing on a difference, but focusing what we've got together. And people know that that's good. I've been going around telling people that everybody here, they want me and sister and the other monks, they want us to work together with people of other religions. You demand that of us. People of the world demand of their imams, they demand of their Christian priests, they demand of their fathers, they demand of their rabbis. Too much separation and war, that's evil. Walls which separate people, ideas which create barriers between sometimes husbands and wives, between peoples of our world. Most people are demanding that your leaders actually work together to actually to mend those barriers, to create harmony and peace as much as possible in this world. Isn't that good? Why? Because it creates peace, happiness and harmony in this world. Why are barriers bad? Because it creates pain. It creates hurt. So you have to look in a newspaper, that terrible concrete wall is ugly. It separates brothers and sisters, parents and children in Palestine. It doesn't feel right. I don't know the ins and outs of the politics of the Middle East, but whatever creates such hurt and harm, it can't be right. You feel it inside. You don't need to be a political scientist to know that. You don't need to be a political science that sometimes the barriers between a man and a woman when they get upset and angry. You realise that's wrong. Why do we sort of say such things and hurt each other so badly? Why do we focus on the faults and think, you've done something wrong, I'm going to give you back more, twice? There's no forgiveness there. There's no creating happiness. There's no creating goodness in this world. So don't you know what goodness is? Why don't you feel it inside yourself, in your heart, in your guts? You know what happiness is. You know what the world needs. And of course, you'll be out there doing it, helping and harming. How's a helping, not harming? Not because you're a goody-goody, not because you're trying to prove something, not because you're trying to go to heaven, not because you're going to try and make more karma good points for yourself for your next life. You do it because it's the only thing you can do. It's natural. It creates happiness for yourself. How many people want to be happy? We think happiness comes, some people think happiness comes from going to see a good movie. Happiness comes from having some good sex. Not that I know anything about that. But happiness comes from, I don't know what makes you happy, your football team winning. Right, look in your life. Does that really make you happy? Right, look at the times when you've really done some service. You've done something good for somebody else. When I was awarded that medal, one of the things I said was, why me? I said that as a rhetorical question, actually to get an answer, not just to leave a question hanging in midair. And as it happened, just the last week, a man had come to my monastery who was suicidal. And he, for one reason or another, he thought that, I think he was facing a prison term, and he just couldn't stand the idea. And he told me, he said, that simile of asking the cat, you want to die? He said, I asked myself, I said, I want to die. And I talked to him for a while. And I gave him my little book, you know, the Opening the Door of Your Heart book. And I thought that was actually a last resort. I gave it to him for free. I was supposed to actually, it belongs to the Buddhist Society, I was supposed to be selling it, not giving it to free. And I apologized for that, but I gave it to him for free. But I really thought that I hadn't got home. I really thought that he was a lost cause. I really thought I'd never see him again, except maybe seeing his picture in the paper, another suicide. And I've met many people, and some people have committed suicide. I've been in this business a long time now. I thought I'd lost that one. But he came back again. And again and again and again. Every two or three days he was there today. I saved his life. Imagine what you feel like when you know that what you've said, what you've done, has actually saved a person from killing themselves, saved their family from all that suffering. There's huge happiness inside. So when I thought about that, I said, yeah, maybe I do deserve that medal. What's wrong with praising yourself? It's not a praising a good act. Fair enough. That, just that one thing creates enormous happiness inside of me. Just I've done something good for somebody else. Just spent a bit of time with them, even though I shouldn't have done. Now, this is what we mean by goodness. It creates happiness for yourself and happiness for others. And once you get into this, you get blissed out being a good person. Goodness becomes fun. That's why we have the saying in Australia, have a good time. Do you want a good time? It's obvious, then be good. If you want a bad time, then be bad. So I am a good time monk. But because the goodness in itself, you feel that and you do it. And this is what we're starting off basic Buddhism. Do what is good, stop doing what is bad, and purify your heart, purify your mind. Your mind starts to feel pure. It gets energy. It starts to understand what's going on, what the meaning of life is. What are you supposed to be doing with yourself in this world? Searching for happiness, but searching in the wrong place. Search inside, in your mind, in your heart, and you feel you know what's good. It's still a wonder for the monks. Somebody said this, one of the anagogues, that they can't figure out why so many people come every day during our retreat to feed us. We don't eat one meal a day in my monastery. We eat one banquet a day. You go down and see the table's always full. We can't get any more tables in that room. And sometimes they're just pushing a dish this and away and that way to try and get another dish on. And then sometimes people come bring some upstairs for us as well. We have one banquet a day. Why do people do that? No, actually, for people to bring food to the monks at Serpentine or to the sisters at Kichigana, sometimes they get up really early in the morning and have to get all that food and they cook that food. It's not just ordinary food. If they go to the monasteries, they cook the very best food. Sometimes, early on when I was a young monk, the Thai ladies would come and amazing food. And the husbands, the Australian husbands, would come and complain. They would tell us, say, my wife never makes that beautiful food for me. only for you monks. And the wife would say, well, husband, you become a monk, and I make money. But why do they do that? And there's much more food than a group of monks could actually take. There's lots left over. I mean, usually it goes to the kangaroos and all these other birds and stuff which rely on our monastery. If it doesn't, it gets taken home. It always gets used somewhere. But they do that because they get happy in happiness. I asked them once, I knew what the answer would be. I asked them in public, why do you come every day? You spend all that time, all that money. It's most of the day because by the time you get back, it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The whole day is gone. Why? And they say, because of happiness. They wouldn't miss that for the world. When you give from your heart, kindness, time, love, whatever, when you give to other people, you get so much back yourself. You purify the heart. When you just think about yourself, what I want, what I need, you gather, you attach, you crave for yourself. What happens? You find that you don't feel good at all. You feel sort of empty. You feel lonely. I always remember the time when I went to a house in Shelley on the riverfront. It was a mansion full of much marble to do a blessing ceremony. The lady just moved into this house. She must have been a millionaireess at least, probably multi-millionaireess. And I just went in there and thought, what a wonderful house this is, with chandeliers, with marble. This is no joke. It's a funny story, and I've told it before, but it's true. I wanted to go to the toilet. She had to draw me a map. Yeah. It was that big a house. But the painful thing was, talking to that lady, she lived in that huge mansion alone. She had no friends, no relations. Well, she had relations, but none she got on with. She was such a lonely, lonely woman. And I thought, what's the use of a big house like that when there's no friends to enjoy it with? And it was so sad. It was almost a paradigm of our modern world where people seek for the big houses, the big cars, the material comfort, but they don't find emotional comfort. If they do make it, they've got no one to share it with. What would you prefer? A small little home, but with good friends, with good companions and nice family, or a big mansion where you're alone? What's happiness? You know what happiness is inside. You don't need to hear that in a book. You know that. You feel that. Even though there's been many supposed to be on retreat, I have come into town on several occasions, mostly for funerals. People have died in the last 2 or 3 months. I enjoy going to funerals. Do you like funerals? They're so meaningful because, number one, you can help and serve those people who actually face with this thing about a death. And it's one of those occasions when you're giving a talk when everybody listens. And sometimes you've got the emotions in the palm of your hand. I tell jokes at my funerals. And they all say, thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm, for telling jokes. Please let us have another one. Often I've seen that coffin rattle as the one inside is probably laughing. No, I haven't. That's a joke. But the thing I like about funerals is you get people going up there on the lectern and saying all these wonderful stories about the person who's died. I love hearing those stories. They're celebrating a life. The last funeral I went to, I think it was last Wednesday or something. No, about a week ago. I forget when, but not that long ago. I'll tell you, it was a young boy. Yeah, well, young man. He's 34, 35 when he died, cancer. And they were telling him about when he was young. And I think his mate, who grew up with, they managed to find some detonator caps And they blew up a builder's toilet next door. It was just like fun and games were growing up. They were celebrating life and all the naughty, silly things they'd done. But they didn't want to punish each other for that. They were just growing up. I saw forgiveness there. This was boys being boys. And the girl, they got in big trouble for that. And the girl was telling about, you know, their lives together. It was beautiful celebrating a life, even 34 years. That's why I love funerals, because they're celebrating living and goodness. Because that's what you talk about when somebody dies. You understand. I love funerals because that's where you get some of the deepest spiritual messages about the meaning of life. If you want to know what life's meaning is, go to Karakata or Fremantle, or hang out in one of the chapels. No one will know. Listen to people's lives and what they remember. They remember all the goodness, the wonderful things which a person does. And the time when they did silly things, the time when they just helped and served, good friends, good family. There you learn what goodness is, what the meaning of life is. There you're purifying your heart of selfishness. You're not living in a mansion by yourself. You're not living in this body, the mansion of your body, alone. You've got all of your friends, all of your goodness, all of your wonderful memories, all of the great things which you've done, which mean something to you. That is what's important. That is what heals and helps. I'll finish off with a story which comes to mind. There was a time when I was very active teaching in prisons. This was a time I was teaching at Carnot, which is very close to our monastery. I've been teaching this group of prisoners. Most of the prisoners, not all, but most of the prisoners who came into my group were in jail because of drug trafficking or, you know, selling drugs. They were drug dealers. And these two prisoners, well, there's one prisoner, when I arrived there for the meditation session, took my hand and dragged me into the schoolroom. He wanted to show me something. On the board in the schoolroom was again all these cards written by kids. He told me that the week before he'd been invited to Jarrahdale Primary School with a mate of his by one of the school teachers. He was a criminal in jail because of drug dealing. This amazing teacher in the school got these two druggies, criminals, to talk to the children about drugs. She could have got some psychologist from Perth, some academic who'd done a degree and had studied other people. That wouldn't have meant a fraction of what these two prisoners did. These two prisoners stood in front of that class of 10-year-olds and told them what drugs are really like from their heart. And what happens, you know, when you start getting involved in this sort of stuff. And I, of course, I wasn't at that school, but I imagined just the effect on those kids. Those kids would never touch drugs at all, because those prisoners were talking from their heart, from experience, not as theory. They were talking from their guts about what happens. They would have communicated. But the lovely part of this story was, like most schools, after the prisoners had left, in the class, get the crayons out, let's write some cards to thank Nick, I forget the other guy's name. And they had all these beautiful cards pasted on the wall of the school board. Nick, thank you so much for coming. I'll never take drugs. Nick, when you're released, please come and visit again. Nick, thanks so much for what you did. We hope you get released soon, get pardoned. And as this Nick, this drug dealer, was showing with his cards, first he just was teary-eyed, and then he was weeping, just crying his eyes out. That meant so much to him. He'd done something for other people. One of the awful things about being in a jail is your ability to contribute to the happiness of others is taken away. You can't help. You can't serve. You can't give. You can't love. There, he had the chance to do that. I met him at Perth Airport many years later. I was sitting in a chair waiting for a monk to arrive. I spent a lot of time waiting for monks to arrive at airports. As I was waiting there, someone put their hand on my shoulder and I turned around in a very sharp suit. He's obviously doing very well for himself, was Nick. I recognised him straight away and he smiled at me. And his first words were, "Brahm, I'm still meditating." Now that's what goodness does. Now doesn't that uplift you? Isn't that what life is all about? Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that wonderful? Do you need to read that in the book? Did I really need to tell you that? You just know that already, but sometimes we forget. Sometimes we get sidetracked. Sometimes we follow other ways. Please do what is good. Just forgive. Stop doing what is bad. Don't harm or hurt others. You find your mind gets purified. What do you mean by purified mind? Doesn't it mean like putting in a washing machine and just getting all the stains out? What is a pure mind? You say someone is pure-hearted. Isn't it there, always there for you? Always giving, never say a bad word about anybody. Kind, compassionate, wise. What is wisdom? Wisdom comes from that pure heart. You're a good person, you're a kind person. Then the mind opens up and you get wiser and wiser and wiser. Wisdom comes from goodness. And it grows and grows and makes you even more good. Not good in the sense of being proud, but good in the sense of being free. Freedom to be able to love, to care and to give happiness in this world to both yourself and to all other beings. It's the heart of the Buddhist teaching. It's the heart of spirituality. It's put in terms which you don't have to have fancy terms from the books. It's terms which everybody can understand. As you open up your heart, wisdom comes. That's why that title of the book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, to goodness, to peace, to the inner wisdom. And that way, you become happy little people. And the more happy people we have in the world, the more harmony we'll have. And have more harmony, the more peace we can have in our fractured world. To do what is good, to stop doing what is bad, and purify your mind, to make it more brilliant, more happy, more smiley. That's the teaching of the Buddha, the ending of suffering. Okay, there we go. Okay, has anyone got any questions? You got one at the back there, yes. Very quick. Aha. If you get ego building, you'll start getting critical of others. You start judging yourself against others. But praising yourself is actually, you find you get less critical of others. So you're praising your goodness, you're praising your kindness, you're praising your generosity. You actually, that you don't get big-headed at all. You get big-hearted. Try it and see. Don't get big-headed, you get big-hearted. Okay?